Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called on January 4th as I was leaving for Israel, my first stop before Turkey, to say, "I had you on my mind," about Syria and Afghanistan, noting that there was a high level of alarm around the Senate over recent developments. I said the key objective of my trip was to get straight exactly what we were going to do in Syria. Indeed, in an on-the-record meeting with the press traveling with me on Sunday, January 6th, at Jerusalem's King David Hotel, I said, "We expect that those who have fought with us in Syria, in the opposition, particularly the Kurds, but everybody who's fought with us, is not put in jeopardy by the coalition withdrawal. It's a point the president has made very clear in his conversations with President Erdogan of Turkey." That is, in fact, what Trump had said, and it was correct when I said it in Israel. Later in the day, Washington time, asked by a reporter about my remarks as he was boarding Marine One for Camp David, Trump said, "John Bolton is right now over there, as you know, and I have two great stars, and John Bolton is doing a great job, and Mike Pompeo is doing a great job. They're very strong, and they work hard. We're coming up with some very good results." It is also true, of course, that Trump changed his mind again when the Turks pushed back after reading this and other comments I made in Jerusalem, meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. But that's where we were at the trip's start. Trump called me at about 11:45 p.m. on January 6th, saying, "You're awake, right?" Which I assuredly was not. Someone had told him the Turks were unhappy with various of my remarks reported in the press. Of course, I hadn't said anything Trump hadn't said to Erdogan. Nonetheless, Trump said several times during this brief call, "My base wants to get out of Syria," which meant visiting Turkey would certainly be fun. Indeed, the next day, as we flew from Jerusalem, the embassy in Ankara was hearing Erdogan was so irritated that he might cancel the meeting scheduled with me. In diplomatic circles, this was seen as a slight, but I saw it as proof our Syria policy was right on the mark from the U.S. perspective, if not Turkey's. After I arrived in Ankara at 4:35 p.m. local time, Pompeo called to report Trump was unhappy with a New York Times story filled with even more than the usual quota of mistakes, recounting contradictions in our Syria policy, citing statements from administration officials. Of course, many of the contradictions came from Trump himself, and Pompeo agreed he had made a few statements tracking mine, such as saying we would not allow Turkey to slaughter the Kurds, which had not received widespread media attention, but which certainly irritated the Turks. We agreed our embassy should not plead for a meeting with Erdogan, and that we had perhaps reached the moment we knew was inevitable, where Trump's desire to exit Syria came crashing into his statement about protecting the Kurds. That was something Erdogan would not tolerate. Trump called me about an hour later. He didn't like the reporting on internal administration disagreements, but he was mostly worried whether the Defense Department was still working hard on the two-week plan to defeat the ISIS caliphate. I urged him to call Shanahan to reassure himself and said I was seeing Dunford shortly in Ankara and would also follow up with him. Ironically, the next day the Washington Post reported unhappily that Trump and I were actually on the same page on Syria. Unhappily, because the Post was contradicting its own story from the day before. All this confused press coverage reveals both the inconsistencies within Trump's own thinking and reporting based on second- and third-hand sources, exacerbated under a president who spent a disproportionate share of his time watching his administration being covered in the press. It is difficult beyond description to pursue a complex policy in a contentious part of the world when the policy is subject to instant modification based on the boss's perception of how inaccurate and often already outdated information is reported by writers who don't have the administration's best interests at heart in the first place. It was like making and executing policy inside a pinball machine, not the West Wing of the White House. In the meantime, contrary to the statement of principles, Jim Jeffrey circulated a color-coded map showing which parts of northeastern Syria he proposed to allow Turkey to take over and which the Kurds could retain. Dunford didn't like what the map showed at all. I asked if our objective should not be to keep the Turks entirely on their side of the border with Syria east of the Euphrates River, and Dunford said that was certainly his position. I said I wanted to see northeastern Syria look much as it did now, but without U.S. troops being present. I knew that might be mission impossible, but thought it should at least be the objective we sought, even if we couldn't reach it. Dunford agreed. At this point, Jeffrey finally wandered in, and we went through the draft statement of principles we could give to the Turks. I added a new sentence to make clear we didn't want to see the Kurds mistreated and took pains to show we didn't accept a Turkish presence, military or otherwise, in northeastern Syria. Dunford and Jeffrey agreed to the draft, which, along with the map in light of developments after I left the White House, is now purely a matter of historical interest. Not surprisingly, Erdogan let us know he was canceling his meeting with me because he had to deliver a speech in Parliament. As we learned later, Erdogan's speech was a pre-planned attack on what I presented as the U.S. position. Erdogan had not moved an inch from his insistence that Turkey have a free hand in northeastern Syria, which we could not allow if we wanted to prevent retribution against the Kurds. Erdogan essentially gave a campaign speech just prior to nationwide local and provincial elections in which Erdogan's supporters would soon fare badly, saying no concessions and that it was not possible to make compromises on the point. On the way back, I spoke with Pompeo to brief him on the Turkey meetings. We agreed our views on the Kurds were irreconcilable with Turkey's and they needed to be really careful. Pompeo said Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu was trying to reach him and that he planned to say, "You have a choice. You can either have us on your border or the Russians and the Iranians, who would almost certainly move into northeastern Syria when we withdrew. Your choice." I said that sounded right to me. Next, I called Trump to report in. He thought the Turks had been ready months before to cross into Syria, which is why he wanted to get out to begin with, before Turkey attacked the Kurds with our people still in place. He continued, "Erdogan doesn't care about ISIS," which was true, and said the U.S. would remain capable of hitting ISIS after we left Syria, also true. Trump was focused on his speech that evening on the Mexico border wall, the first of his administration from the Oval Office, and he added, "Just don't show any weakness or anything," as if he didn't realize I was describing things that had already happened. "We don't want to be involved in a civil war. They're natural enemies. The Turks and the Kurds have been fighting for many years. We're not getting involved in a civil war, but we are finishing off ISIS." Meanwhile, I learned that Dunford thought Turkish military commanders were a lot less interested in going into Syria than Erdogan and were looking for reasons they could use to avoid conducting military operations south of their border while simultaneously saying they were protecting Turkey from terrorist attacks. To them, said Dunford, "This is our Mexico border on steroids." Dunford had proceeded consistently with the statement of principles, proposing a 20 to 30 kilometer buffer zone from which Kurdish heavy weapons would be removed and which would be patrolled by an international force consisting largely of NATO allies and the like, who would ensure there were no Kurdish incursions into Turkey, and vice versa, as we had discussed earlier in Washington. The U.S. would continue to provide air cover and search and rescue capabilities for the international force, which Dunford and I believed would also allow us to keep control of the airspace over northeastern Syria. Although Dunford didn't stress it, because we were staying at Al-Assad in Iraq under Trump's direction, we would also be able, if the need arose, to return to northeastern Syria quickly and in force to suppress any serious reappearance of an ISIS terrorist threat. Since Erdogan's real priority was domestic politics, in my view, this arrangement might be enough. We now had to convince the Europeans to agree, but that was a problem for another day. While we played this string out, or developed a better idea, which might take months, we had a good argument for maintaining U.S. forces east of the Euphrates. As for the Kurds, Jeffrey would present the idea to their commander, General Mazlum Abdi, to see how he reacted. Dunford was fatalistic, believing that Mazlum's options were quite limited, and that he might as well consider some insurance now. I then spoke with Pompeo, who thought this the proper line to pursue, and that others in the region would support it. The Arab states had no love for Turkey, and they had financial resources that could make it easier for NATO allies and others to justify participating in a multinational monitoring force. Getting more equitable burden sharing from our allies, NATO in particular, was a constant Trump theme, and a correct one. In the 1990-91 Persian Gulf conflict, George H.W. Bush had financed our war efforts by soliciting contributions from the beneficiaries in the region, like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, and also other more distant beneficiaries like Japan. It was done with a tinge of embarrassment, referred to lightly as the tin cup exercise, but it had worked, and no one suggested it was dishonorable. There was no reason it might not work again. I continued to explain this approach in Syria to Trump. In the Oval, for another issue on January 9th, Dunford made a more detailed presentation on why an international force in a buffer zone south of Turkey's border was doable, allowing us to extricate ourselves without profoundly endangering the Kurds and our other anti-ISIS allies, not to mention our international reputation. Dunford now vigorously defended staying in At-Tanif, which Jordan's King Abdullah had also pressed on Pompeo during his visit, noting that the longer we stayed in At-Tanif, the more secure Jordan was against the risk of the conflict in Syria's spilling across the border into his country. Trump was pleased the 2 to 4 week plan was underway, although he still expected results in 2 weeks, which wasn't happening. He seemed satisfied, but it didn't stop a long digression on Mattis's failure to win in Afghanistan and Syria. Then he was off wondering why, after having fought the Korean War in the 1950s, we were still there, as well as critiquing the freeloading and ingratitude of sundry allies around the world. Just for the record, I did discuss with Trump several times the history of the temporary 1945 division of the Korean Peninsula, the rise of Kim Il-sung, the Korean War, and its Cold War significance. You know, that old stuff. But I obviously made no impact. We endured this cycle repeatedly, always with the same outcome. Every few days, someone would inadvertently press a button somewhere, and Trump would be repeating his lines from the same movie soundtrack. Dunford did a good job defending himself, and with minimal interference running by me, because I thought it was better to let Trump hear it from someone else for a change. Others in the room, Pence, Shanahan, Coates, Haspel, Mnuchin, Sullivan, and more, largely remained silent. This was the longest conversation between Dunford and Trump I had seen, the first one without Mattis present. Dunford handled himself well, and I wondered how different things might have been if Mattis hadn't acted like a 5-star general commanding all the 4-star generals, but a real Secretary of Defense running the entire vast Pentagon machinery. Watching Dunford perform, it occurred to me there was a hidden wisdom in the statutory prohibition against former general officers becoming Secretary of Defense. It was not fear of a military takeover, but ironically, that neither the civilian nor the military side of the Pentagon's leadership performed so well when both were military. The secretary's broader, inevitably political role ill-suited someone with a military background, leaving Mattis just to supervise Dunford and the other joint chiefs, who really didn't need more military supervision. It also underscored how unpersuasive Mattis was in meetings in either the sit room or the Oval. He may have established a reputation as a warrior scholar for carrying with him on the battlefield a copy of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, but he was no debater. All these negotiations about our role in Syria were complicated by Trump's constant desire to call Assad on U.S. hostages, which Pompeo and I thought undesirable. Fortunately, Syria saved Trump from himself, refusing even to talk to Pompeo about them. When we reported this, Trump responded angrily, "You tell them he will get hit hard if they don't give us our hostages back. So fucking hard. You tell him that. We want them back within 1 week of today, or they will never forget how hard we'll hit them." That, at least, took the Trump-Assad call off the table. We didn't act on the talk about striking Syria. Efforts to create the International Monitoring Force, however, did not make progress. 1 month later, on February 20th, Shanahan and Dunford said it would be an absolute precondition for other potential troop contributors that there be at least some U.S. forces on the ground in the buffer zone south of Turkey's border, with logistical support coming from al-Assad in Iraq. I certainly had no problem with the idea, but raising it with Trump was undoubtedly dicey. In an Oval Office pre-brief for another Erdogan call the next day, I said the Pentagon believed unless we kept a couple of hundred, a deliberately vague phrase, U.S. troops on the ground, we simply could not put a multilateral force together. Trump thought for a second and then agreed to it. Erdogan said he really wanted Turkey to have exclusive control of what he called the safe zone inside northeastern Syria, which I thought unacceptable. With the speakerphone on the Resolute desk on mute, I suggested to Trump he simply tell Erdogan Dunford was handling those negotiations. The Turkish military would be in Washington the next day, and we should just let the military-to-military talks continue. Trump followed through. Afterward, I raced to my office to tell Shanahan the good news. A few hours later, I called Dunford to be sure he had heard, and he said, "Ambassador, I don't have much time to talk because we're going outside right now for the ceremony to rename the Pentagon the Bolton Building." He was as pleased as we all were and agreed that a couple of hundred was a good figure of speech, which could mean up to 400 without too much poetic license. He would make clear to the Turks he didn't want any of their troops south of the border. I called Lindsey Graham, urging him to keep it quiet so others didn't have a chance to reverse it, which he said he would do, also volunteering to call Erdogan, with whom he had good relations, to urge full support for Trump's decision. Unfortunately, Sanders issued a press statement without clearing it with anyone who knew the facts, which caused significant confusion. We had to explain that a couple of hundred only applied to northeastern Syria, not at Tanif, where there would be another 200 or so U.S. forces, for a total north of 400. I deliberately never tried to pin it down more precisely, despite the media confusion. Dunford also assured me he had calmed down U.S. Central Command, which was worried about contradictory news reports saying, "Don't worry, the building is still named after you." With occasional bumps in the road, this was the situation in northeastern Syria until I resigned. ISIS's territorial caliphate was eliminated, but its terrorist threat remained unabated. Prospects for a multilateral observer force deteriorated, but the U.S. presence remained, fluctuating around 1,500 countrywide. How long this status quo could last was unknowable, but Dunford preserved it through the September 30th end of his term as chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Erdogan's belligerence remained unchecked, perhaps because of Turkey's deteriorating economy and his own domestic political troubles. Trump refused to impose any sanctions for Erdogan's S-400 purchase, ignoring widespread congressional dismay. When Trump finally erupted on October 6, 2019, and again ordered a U.S. withdrawal, I had left the White House nearly a month earlier. The result of Trump's decision was a complete debacle for U.S. policy and for our credibility worldwide. Whether I could have averted this result, as happened 9 months before, I do not know. but the strongly negative bipartisan political reaction Trump received was entirely predictable and entirely justified. To have stopped it a second time would have required someone to stand in front of the bus again and find an alternative that Trump could accept. That, it seems, did not happen. There was some good news, however. After years of effort, on October 26th, the Pentagon and the CIA eliminated ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in a daring raid. Afghanistan, a forward defense. By late 2018, Afghanistan was undoubtedly a sore spot for Trump, one of his principal grievances against the axis of adults so beloved by the media. Trump believed, not without justification, he had given Mattis all the leeway he requested to finish the Taliban, as with finishing the ISIS territorial caliphate. In Iraq and Syria, the stated goal had been accomplished. Whether it should have been the only goal is a different story. In Afghanistan, by contrast, the stated goal was not in sight, and things were undeniably going the wrong way. That grated on Trump. He believed he had been right in 2016. He believed he had been right after the military failures in 2017 and 2018, and he wanted to do what he wanted to do. A reckoning was coming. Trump opposed a continuing U.S. military presence in Afghanistan for two related reasons. First, he had campaigned to end the endless wars in faraway places, and second, the sustained mishandling of economic and security assistance, inflaming his instinct against so much frivolous spending in federal programs. Besides, Trump believed he had been right in Iraq, and everyone now agreed with him. Well, not everyone. The argument I pressed again and again regarding all the endless wars was that we hadn't started the wars and couldn't end them just by our own say-so. Across the Islamic world, the radical philosophies that had caused so much death and destruction were ideological, political, as well as religious. Just as religious fervor had driven human conflicts for millennia, so it was driving this one against America and the West more broadly. It wasn't going away because we were tired of it or because we found it inconvenient to balancing our budget. Most important of all, this wasn't a war about making Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, or any other country nicer, safer places to live. I am not a nation builder. I do not believe what is, after all, an essentially Marxist analysis that a better economic way of life will divert people from terrorism. This was about keeping America safe from another 9/11, or even worse, a 9/11 where the terrorists had nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. As long as the threat existed, no place was too far away to worry about. The terrorists weren't coming to America on wooden sailing ships. By the time I arrived, this debate had been through many iterations, so I did not face a clean slate. My first involvement was May 10, 2018, later in the day after the post-midnight return of the hostages from Korea, when Zalmay Khalilzad, a friend I had known since the Bush 41 administration, who had succeeded me as ambassador to the UN in 2007, came to visit. Zal, as everyone called him, an Afghan-American and also former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, said he had been approached by people purporting to speak on behalf of various Taliban factions who wanted to talk peace. He had spoken to others in the U.S. government who could evaluate the bona fides of these approaches, but he wanted to give me an early heads up in case they proved real, which by late July, Khalilzad told me they had. I saw no reason further contacts shouldn't proceed, not that I expected much, and he initially became a back-channel negotiator with the Taliban. Within a month, the role had expanded to Khalilzad's being one of the growing number of State Department special envoys, a convenient role that avoided having them confirmed in more traditional state positions. Given Trump's periodic eruptions on our continuing military presence in Afghanistan, there was a growing sense we should have a full NSC meeting, or at least a military briefing, before the end of the year. I wanted any briefing to be as far after the elections as possible, but for reasons I never understood, Mattis wanted it sooner. It was finally scheduled for November 7th, the day after the congressional midterms. I was sure Trump would be unhappy about the Republicans losing control of the House, no matter what happened in the Senate. Did Mattis, in particular, want a flat-out Trump decision to withdraw, so Mattis could then resign on a matter of principle? Or was this an institutional Pentagon effort to have Trump be squarely responsible, not U.S. failings during the course of the war, and especially not the collapse of the beloved counterinsurgency strategy that had failed in both Afghanistan and Iraq? Pompeo agreed with me that the briefing should have been held later in November, but we couldn't stop it. At 1 p.m. on Election Day, I met with Khalilzad, who thought he had more time to negotiate with the Taliban than I believed likely, given my expectation Trump would pull the plug, perhaps the next day. Pence told me Mattis still argued we were making military progress in Afghanistan and should not change course. Pence knew as well as I that Trump didn't believe that, and there was substantial evidence Mattis was wrong. Here, once again, it wasn't so much that I disagreed with Mattis substantively as it was frustrating that he was determined to run into the wall on Afghanistan as on Syria, and that he had no alternative line of argument to avoid getting the wrong answer. Kellogg sat in on the Pence-Mattis meeting and told me later Mattis simply repeated what he had said for 2 years. No wonder Trump was frustrated with what he called his generals. To my litigator's instincts, this was the sure way to lose. In truth, I didn't have a better answer, which is why I wanted more space after the elections before having this briefing. At 2 p.m. on November 8th, we convened in the Oval with Pence, Mattis, Dunford, Kelly, Pompeo, Coates, Haspel, myself, and others present. Pompeo led off, but Trump quickly interjected. "We're being beaten, and they know they're beating us." Then he was off, raging against the statutorily mandated Afghanistan Inspector General, whose reports repeatedly documented wasted tax dollars, but also provided amazingly accurate information about the war that any other government would have kept private. "I think he's right," said Trump, "but I think it's a disgrace he can make such things public." Mentioning Khalilzad, Trump said, "I hear he's a con man, although you need a con man for this." Pompeo tried again, but Trump rolled on. "My strategy," meaning what his generals had talked him into in 2017, "was wrong, and not at all where I wanted to be. We've lost everything. It was a total failure. It's a waste. It's a shame. All the casualties. I hate talking about it." Then Trump raised the first combat use of the MOAB, Massive Ordnance Air Blast, "without your knowledge," said Trump to Mattis, complaining for the umpteenth time that the MOAB had not had its intended effect. As was often the case, Trump had truth mixed with misunderstanding and malice. Mattis had delegated to the U.S. commander in Afghanistan authority to use the MOAB, so further authorization was unnecessary. As for the MOAB's effects, that remained a matter of dispute within the Pentagon. One thing was sure. Mattis was not going to win this argument with Trump, who knew what he wanted to know, period. I knew he didn't want this briefing. Predictably, Mattis ran right into his favorite wall, lauding the efforts of other NATO members. "We pay for NATO," said Trump. "ISIS is still in Afghanistan," said Mattis. Trump said, "Let Russia take care of them. We're 7,000 miles away, but we're still the target. They'll come to our shores. That's what they all say," said Trump, scoffing. "It's a horror show. At some point, we've got to get out." Coates offered that Afghanistan was a border security issue for America, but Trump wasn't listening. "We'll never get out. This was done by a stupid person named George Bush, he said to me. Millions of people killed, trillions of dollars, and we just can't do it. Another 6 months, that's what they said before, and we're still getting our asses kicked. Then he launched into a favorite story about how we helicoptered school teachers every day to their school because it was too dangerous for them to go on their own. Costs a fortune. The IG was right, he said, veering off into a report about the construction of a billion-dollar Holiday Inn, and saying, this is incompetence on our part. They hate us, and they shoot us in the back, blew the back of the guy's head off, arms and legs and things, referring to a recent green-on-blue attack where a Utah National Guardsman was killed. India builds a library and advertises it all over. On it went. We've got to get out. My campaign was to get out. People are angry. The base wants out. My people are very smart. It's why Dean Heller lost his Nevada Senate re-election bid. He supported Hillary. Mattis tried again, but Trump was on to Syria. I don't understand why we're killing ISIS in Syria. Why aren't Russia and Iran doing it? I've played this game for so long. Why are we killing ISIS for Russia and Iran? Iraq, which is controlled by Iran. Pompeo gave in, saying, if that's the guidance, we'll execute it. But the story is that we won't get victory. Trump answered, that's Vietnam. And why are we guarding South Korea from North Korea? Pompeo said, just give us 90 days. But Trump responded, the longer we take, the more it's my war. I don't like losing wars. We don't want this to be our war. Even if we did win, we get nothing. I could see it coming. Sure enough, Mattis said, it's your war the day you took office. Trump was ready. The first day I took office, I should have ended it. And on it went. And on. Trump finally asked, how long do you need? And Pompeo said, until February or March. We'll prepare the options to exit. Trump was furious. Furious he was hearing what he had heard so many times before. They've got it down so fucking pat. Then he was back to criticizing Khalilzad and whether anything the Taliban signed would be worth anything. How do we get out without our guys getting killed? How much equipment will we leave? Dunford spoke for the first time, saying, not much. How do we get out? Asked Trump. We'll build a plan, said Dunford. I had been silent throughout because the whole meeting was a mistake. Inevitably, Trump asked, John, what do you think? I said, it sounds like my option is in the rearview mirror, explaining again why we should counter terrorists in their home base and why Pakistan's nuclear weapons program made it imperative to preclude a Taliban haven in Afghanistan that might accelerate Pakistan's falling to terrorists. Dunford said if we withdrew, he feared a terrorist attack on the U.S. in the near future. Trump was off again. $50 billion a year! Until he ran down and said to no one in particular, you have until Valentine's Day. Most participants filed out of the Oval dispirited, although Pompeo and I remained behind as Sanders and Bill Shine rushed in to say Jeff Sessions had resigned as Attorney General, the first of many year-end departures. 1 month later, Trump named Bill Barr to succeed Sessions. Also 1 month later, after another report we were losing ground to the Taliban, Trump exploded again. I should have followed my instincts, not my generals, he said, reverting to the MOABs not having its intended effect. He now didn't want to wait for Khalilzad, but wanted to announce the withdrawal of U.S. forces prior to the end of his second full year in office or even before. If he waited until his third year, he would own the war, whereas if we exited in the second year, he could still blame his predecessors. I said he simply had to address how to prevent terrorist attacks against America once we withdrew. He answered, We'll say we're going to flatten the country if they allow attacks from Afghanistan." I pointed out we had already done that once, and we needed a better answer. I said I might have been the only one worried about Pakistan if the Taliban regained control next door, but Trump interrupted to say he worried as well. The speech had to address that issue. Basically, as we talked, the outline of the speech emerged. "We've done a great job and killed a lot of bad people. Now we're leaving, although we will leave a counterterrorism platform behind." Fortunately, the concept of a counterterrorism platform was already well advanced in Pentagon thinking, but it was hardly the first choice. At my regular breakfast with Mattis and Pompeo, this one on Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, I suggested we seek to answer three questions. Would the Afghan government collapse after we left, and if so, how fast? How fast and in what ways would ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist groups react to withdrawal? And how fast could the various terrorist groups mount attacks on the United States? We scheduled another Oval Office meeting for Monday, and Mattis had barely begun before Trump was all over him. I felt sorry for Mattis, not to mention the country as a whole. After a somewhat shortened version of what he'd said in the prior gathering, Trump concluded, "I want out before January 20th. Do it fast." And then he turned to his visits to Walter Reed, where the wounded soldiers had not had the impact on Trump they have on most people, impressing them with their bravery and commitment to their mission. Trump had simply been horrified by the seriousness of their wounds, oblivious also that advances in military medicine saved many men who would simply have died in earlier wars. Then we were back to the Moab not having its intended effect and other refrains, including that stupid speech in August 2017 where Trump had announced his new Afghanistan strategy of moving on to the offense. "I said you could do whatever you wanted," he said, and glared, looking straight at Mattis. "I gave you complete discretion, except for nuclear weapons, and look what happened." Trump was bitter whenever his 2017 speech came up, but one wonders how he would have felt if the strategy had prevailed. Pompeo told me later that from his CIA perch at the time, he felt Mattis had unfortunately wasted several months in 2017 doing nothing, afraid Trump would reverse himself and start talking again about withdrawing. We certainly could have used those months now. "What's a win in Afghanistan?" Trump asked. Mattis correctly responded, "The United States doesn't get attacked." Finally, switching his tack, Mattis offered, "Let's say we're ending the war, not that we're withdrawing." "Okay, you ready?" Trump asked no one in particular, but using this favorite phrase indicating something big was coming. "Say we have been there for 18 years. We did a great job. If anybody comes here, they will be met like never before. That's what we say," he said. Although Trump then expanded the withdrawal to include Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Then Trump came back at Mattis. "I gave you what you asked for. Unlimited authority. No holds barred. You're losing. You're getting your ass kicked. You failed." This painful repetition demonstrates that Trump, who endlessly stresses he is the only one who makes decisions, had trouble taking responsibility for them. "Can't we delay it, the withdrawal, so we don't lose more men and diplomats?" Mattis asked. Trump roared back, "We can't afford it. We've failed. If it were turning out differently, I wouldn't do it." We wandered disconsolately down to Kelly's office, where we reconnoitered what to do next. Dunford, who had been largely silent, said there was no way to withdraw everyone safely in the time frame Trump wanted, and he would insist on another meeting to explain why. Kelly, totally fed up by this point, said Trump cared only about himself. He was thinking at least in part about Trump's unwillingness, up until that point, to visit Iraq or Afghanistan. Mattis then told Dunford to withdraw everyone from the Afghan boonies back to four or five key bases, from which they would depart the country, and to secure the landing and take-off flight paths of the planes that would lift the men and equipment, as if another four-star Marine general couldn't figure that out on his own. I honestly do not know how Kelly and Dunford restrained themselves from telling Mattis what he could do with his withdrawal plan, but this was the five-star general phenomenon at work. Mattis should have worried about persuading Trump, not nitty-gritty plans on the ground in Afghanistan. Afterward, I walked Pompeo to his car outside the West Wing, agreeing that Trump's assessment of Republican views on Afghanistan was completely wrong. "He's going to get crushed politically," said Pompeo, "and deservedly so." I concluded the generals really were in a cliché, fighting the last war, not dealing effectively with Trump's attitude, which they were partly responsible for. As a latecomer, I saw that what seemed like successes to Mattis and his colleagues, such as the August 2017 Afghanistan speech, were, in retrospect, mistakes. Trump had been pushed far beyond where he wanted to go, and now he was overreacting in the other direction. The media's hallowed axis of adults was not alone in this mistake, but before we could recover, we had to admit the misperception of Trump it rested upon. Khalilzad could pick up the pace of his negotiations, but his efforts were disconnected from what was happening on the ground in his country. It looked like there were a grim couple of months ahead. On December 20th, as Pompeo later told me, just hours before his resignation, Mattis gave Pompeo not only his resignation letter, but also other documents, one particularly important here. This was a draft public statement on the operational plans for the Afghan withdrawal, which basically preempted whatever Trump might say about it in his January State of the Union speech. Stunned, Pompeo told Mattis he simply could not release such a document, and that there was no way to edit it to make it acceptable. Mattis asked if he would at least send it along to me, and Pompeo said he knew I would agree with him. Neither Pompeo nor I knew at the time that the Defense Department had drafted an execute order elaborating what the draft statement said and distributed it to U.S. commanders and embassies worldwide, all part of Mattis's resignation scenario. We obviously understood this only hazily in all the confusion, but it produced an explosion of press stories. It reflected a common Mattis tactic, one of spite, to say, in effect, "You want withdrawal? You've got withdrawal." They didn't call him chaos for nothing. Even after Mattis's departure, Shanahan, Pompeo, and I continued the weekly breakfasts. On January 24th, reflecting our divergent views on key points, Shanahan and I worried that Khalilzad was giving away too much, not because he was a poor negotiator, but because those were Pompeo's instructions. The Taliban was insisting that the draft U.S. Taliban statement, itself a troubling concept, under negotiation, say that all foreign forces, meaning us, would withdraw from Afghanistan. That certainly wouldn't leave room for the counterterrorism capabilities, even though Trump said he wanted them. I worried that State was so wrapped up in getting a deal, it was losing the bigger picture, a congenital department problem. Pompeo vigorously disagreed, although he readily conceded the negotiations could go into a ditch at any point, hardly a vote of confidence in the Taliban as a negotiating partner, a term they like at State. The central problem with the diplomatic strategy was that if the Taliban really thought we were leaving, they had no incentive to talk seriously. They could simply wait, as they had often done before, and as Afghans had done for millennia. As the Taliban saying went, "You have the watches, we have the time." The breakfast ended inconclusively, but Shanahan called later saying he remained very nervous about both the pace of the negotiations, which seemed to have picked up considerably, and their substance. Pompeo just wanted to negotiate a deal and declare success, without much more. This dichotomy characterized the internal debate for months to come. The State of the Union was delayed for weeks due to the acrimonious budget fight and partial government shutdown. It was finally scheduled for February 5th, and the key passage on Afghanistan was mercifully brief. In Afghanistan, my administration is holding constructive talks with a number of Afghan groups, including the Taliban. As we make progress in these negotiations, we will be able to reduce our troop presence and focus on counterterrorism. This comment received little attention, but it embodied struggles that persisted until my final days in the White House. At least at this point, there was still hope.